We have in studio today James R. White, who has been on the last 2 hours with Van Hale and is probably pretty tired at this point, drinking glasses of water, trying to keep going on this. And just like to, if I can, kind of change the mode and spirit a little bit of what we've been listening to and try and get into a discussion and in certain areas. We are going to, I'm sure, get down to biblical references and so forth, and we'll let you call in and ask questions in a little while. We want to talk a little bit myself and James before we get into that too much. I just wanted to mention that James was kind enough to send me a copy or a letter before he came. And I'm going right into this, by the way, because today, because we have the special guest and James is not able to be here all that much, and because there is going to be a lot of interest in what he has to say and what we both are going to be discussing, that we will not be, we will not have the religion in the news or focus on doctrine issues or portions of the program today. We're just going to go straight to the interview. James White has a, is it a master in arts, James?
M.A. and T.H.M., right.
Okay, and the THM, that means Master of Theology. Theology, right. And you are the head of Alpha and Omega Ministries, is that correct?
Alpha and Omega Ministries in Phoenix, Arizona, right.
What is Alpha and Omega Ministries?
It's a Christian apologetics organization. We deal primarily in providing a defense of the faith in a what we would call an interfaith context. I have dealt with atheism and things like that. But we primarily focus upon dealing with for example, just to give you an idea, in less than 3 weeks, I'll be debating Father Mitchell Pacwa, a Jesuit scholar and priest on Long Island, on the subject of the papacy. I've done 22 moderated debates against the leading Roman Catholic apologists in the United States on the papacy, justification by faith, the Marian doctrines, issues like that. And a lot of our work is in that area. In fact, one of my books is called The Roman Catholic Controversy, that deals with those issues in regards to the gospel with Roman Catholicism. We also deal with Jehovah's Witnesses, the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society. And every 6 months, we are here in Salt Lake City. This is my 28th consecutive general conference. 14 years have been coming up here. And Van's hair was much darker. He had much more of it back when we first met. And he would tell you that I had much more of it back when we first met, too. I had bushels of it back then, but the genetics caught up with me. And so we've been coming up here for years now. We also track the Easter pageant of the LDS Church in Mesa, which starts next week. In fact, as soon as Josh and I get back, we'll be doing that Tuesday night through Saturday night of next week.
Do you ever listen to the conference?
Yes. In fact, we used to hear it more often than we do now because we used to drive up. So on the way back on Sunday, we would listen to the conference on the way back. Now, of course, with the internet and things like that, you can get synopses of the talks and so on and so forth. And used to be you can hear it pretty well at the Westgate if you were passing out tracks over on that side. You can't hear it nearly as well in the Southgate anymore.
Oh, I guess we'll have to see if they can't pipe it out to you.
Well, that might be interesting, yeah.
Do you some good. That would be great. We'd welcome your being here every if we could only get you to hear it, you know. It says here you're a critical consultant with the NASB update.
Right.
What does that mean?
The New American Standard Bible was updated in 1995. If you've seen the updated edition, and I noticed that you used the NASB in your book, Biblical Mormonism, probably what you have there is, if that's the NASB, it's probably the 77.
88. I have the 88 edition.
Well, that's the Schofield. But if you look in, if you look inside that at the, copyright of the NASB itself, the last date will probably be the 1977, I would assume, at least for the Lachman Foundation.
That's correct, 1977.
That was the last revision that was done before the 1995 update. What we did with the update is, and my work was primarily after most of the work was done, I'm involved in explaining the textual bases of the translation. One of my books, I don't know if you've seen or not, is called The King James Only Controversy.
And yes, I'm familiar with that.
Okay. And I became associated with the Lachman Foundation through doing a debate on the John Ankerberg show, which you may be familiar with.
Yes, I'm familiar with. He wouldn't let me on his program. So.
Well, I was on his program, and we
debated. I would imagine you would. He'd let you on, yes.
we debated some King James-only advocates, and One of the individuals there was Dr. Don Wilkins, who represented the Lachman Foundation. So I began working with the Lachman Foundation along those lines. The main difference is we updated the text to the 26th edition of the Nestle-Aulin in Greek text. There's no more these and thous in the NASB. You may remember in the Psalter, it used thee and thou, and then when it would quote from the Psalms in the New Testament, it would also use thee and thou. Those are no longer there. So there's been an updating, and it's not quite as wooden a translation at some places.
I like wooden translations myself.
The Al Gore type translation.
I frequently go back to one of the things I like about the NASB is that in spite of the translation it chooses, it'll frequently put in the side notes what it a literal or alternative translation, and I almost always find that a preferable translation. But I am interested in, I read an excellent defense of the King James Version. I'm just kind of curious what your response would be. I think it was at Edward Hill, is it?
Edward F. Hills, huh?
Yeah. Hills. He pointed out that, for the sake of our listeners, one of the major differences between the NASB and the King James is the use of fairly recently discovered texts of the Bible. I'm trying to think of them. Codus.
Vaticanus, yes. Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinicus.
Uh-huh. Right. And one of them, I think the Sinaiticus, was discovered in a wastebasket.
Actually, that's not correct.
Well, maybe that's what Hill said, and he said that that it deserved to stay in the wastebasket.
that's a common misapprehension about Sinaiticus. Actually, what he's referring to is Count von Tischendorf was looking for ancient manuscripts in Palestine. He went to the monastery at the Mount at St. Catherine's Monastery. And he saw some monks burning papyri and vellum fragments in the oven. And he looked in one of the waste baskets and found fragments of the Septuagint. And he became very agitated and excited, which was not a good thing to do amongst monks who live on a mountain. And so they wouldn't show him anything after that. Years later, he was visiting again, and he gave a copy of the Septuagint that he had just had printed to one of the monks. And he said, you know, I have this. And he took him to his cell. And he opened, like, the closet area, and he took out of his cell, wrapped in red cloth, what today is known as Codex Sinaiticus. So it was not in a trash can. It was wrapped in red cloth, which for a monk meant this was one of his most precious possessions. And it is a manuscript of both the Old and New Testaments that dates to about around the time of the Council of Nicaea.
It's not complete, though, of the Old and New Testament.
It's very, very complete. There are some pages missing from beginning and end. But it's very, very complete text. And in reality, please realize the NASB, NIV, and other modern translations are not based solely upon Codex Sinaiticus or Vaticanus or Alexandrinus.
Oh, I know that.
See, Hill's really, if you...
No, let me just, before you go on further, just let me point out, because I am curious your reaction to Hill's argument, which was that if this document was a good copy, it would have been used to the point that it would have deteriorated long since and had been replaced by, as they did when they came to a copy that was, you know, when the good copy wears out, they'd make a new copy. And so that the fact that it was so ancient suggested to Hills that people did not regard it as a good copy or a good usable text and therefore had not used it very much. And that would indicate that it was a poor copy of the text. What do you think about that?
That argument actually goes back to Dean Burgon, but it's interesting. It's a two-edged argument. The arguments against Sinaiticus are that, and then the other argument they use is, well, but there are all these textual changes in it. You can't have it both ways. The problem with Sinaiticus is it was used for centuries and centuries and centuries, and most of the scribal emendations took place about the 9th century when someone attempted to update its readings to what was then the current text, what is known as the Byzantine text. It would be like taking your NASB and trying to scratch things out and make it read like the King James Version. You can imagine what that would end up looking like. Obviously, therefore, it was in use, and the simple fact of the matter is the argument that you're presenting from Hills is assuming that the New Testament manuscripts were dealt with like the Old Testament Masoretic manuscripts were dealt with. And the simple fact of the matter is Christians never dealt with the manuscripts the way the Masoretic scribes did in the Jewish tradition.
Now, so, isn't it true that, now when did the Masoretic text start?
Well, you know, that depends on how you date it. The Masoretes flourished around the 10th century. The Masoretic text itself.
The A.D.?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
So the Masoretic text itself, you can trace it earlier than that. But the Masoretes themselves flourished around that particular time in history.
Right.
It's just that Christians treated the scriptures differently than Jews did. The Christians wanted everybody to read about Jesus, and so they let anybody and their uncle make a copy. Back in 93, when the Pope came to Denver for World Youth Day, I went up to Denver with some folks from our ministry. I did some debates up there at Denver Seminary on the papacy, and we also passed out tracts amongst the youth. In fact, at one point, there was about 125,000 youth and two of us. It was really good odds. When the Pope came to town, the Vatican Library sent certain things for an exhibit. One of the things I got to see while the Pope was in town was a papyri manuscript. And the papyri manuscripts go as much as 150 years prior to the time of Sinaiticus. That's where a lot of these arguments have sort of fallen apart, and why most scholars don't accept them anymore, is because they go back to a time when Sinaiticus was the earliest. We've now found new papyri manuscripts that go a century or more earlier, and guess who they agree with? They agree with Sinaiticus. And so we've been able to demonstrate that text did exist even more primitively.
What are some of the differences with the King James text, which is taken primarily from the Byzantine, isn't that correct?
It's the Byzantine textual tradition, and primarily the Byzantine textual tradition is, I call it the expansion of piety. That is, whereas the most ancient text might say the Lord Jesus, the Byzantine's going to say the Lord Jesus Christ. An earlier text might say the Lord, the Byzantine's going to say the Lord Jesus. In other words, there's an expansion of piety that is evident. It's a fuller text in the sense of expanding titles and names of deity and things like that. I did say, and I think you'd find it very interesting because it is being used as a textbook all across the United States. In my book, The King James Only Controversy, I did point out that I have with me, for example, the Textus Receptus, which is the Greek text that underlies the King James. I also have with me here in this particular edition, the modern edition of the Greek New Testament. This happens to be the UBS Third Corrected. It's become the UBS Fourth Edition now. If you apply the same rules of interpretation of exegesis to the Textus Receptus that you apply to the United Bible Society or the Nestle-Aulin text, you will not come up with any different beliefs.
That's what I thought. There's really not that much difference between these texts.
No.
I think that this is of interest to or should be of interest to the Latter-day Saint audience that we have. And this is why I've gone on this long on this issue, because most of the time we don't really always, as members of the church, realize the great care over the centuries that has been taken in trying to provide us today with a really fine, excellent
translation.
Text.
Right.
Now, the translation varies to some degree from various reasons, but we do have a good text, I think, and it has always been interesting to me that the article of faith that says we believe in the Bible as far as it's translated correctly doesn't mention anything about being transcribed correctly.
But most Mormons that I know of, and maybe you've had the same experience, in fact, I noted in your book that you address the alleged contradiction in Acts 9:7, Acts 22:9, as I do in Letters to a Mormon Elder. And you had said this is not a valid contradiction.
Right.
And yet, of all the passages in speaking with over 1,500 LDS missionaries over the past 14 years, that is the single most repeated alleged contradiction that I have encountered.
It's unfortunate.
Well, I'm not holding you accountable, but I'm also saying most LDS people with whom I know believe that translated correctly means transmitted correctly.
Yes, I know. And one of the reasons that I've spent so much time in the first chapter of my book on the text was to try and get Latter-day Saints acquainted with the fact that a great deal of effort has been made to give us a good text. Mm-hmm. It's where we run into trouble is with the translation. I find Hebrew to be especially challenging.
And so do I. I'll be teaching it this fall for Golden Gate Baptist Theological Seminary, it's a very difficult thing to present to people.
Well, I've never taught it. I'm just self-taught in it. But I do use an interlinear Bible, Greek, Hebrew, English, by J.P. Green. Are you familiar with that one?
Yes, and probably that will then use the TR. The Textus Receptus.
Yes, I'm sure it does.
In fact, I have the same thing that you have there, and it does definitely use the Textus Receptus.
Yeah, it's quite good.
He's not King James only, but he's Byzantine only, basically.
Is he only Byzantine only?
Primarily, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know whether Sinaiticus would have a difference on this, but, you know, while you were talking with Van Hale, I was looking up a few things, and one of the things that I thought was interesting in the NASB it says on Isaiah 29:16 mm-hmm. that you were talking about, it says that that the error was in, your perversion, it says in the original Hebrew, as far as I get the translation from here, mm-hmm. As I read it in this version, it's you have counted the creator equal to the pot, to the clay. You have counted, no, you've accounted
considered
him
as, right,
not as equal clay. To, not equal, equal's not in there. In fact, as I, the Hebrew symbol or the letter that would make it be as equal to mm-hmm. is notably absent from this text. I don't know if you have that. Do you notice that? Any difference in the...
No, I don't believe there's any. There's okay. Nothing indicated in the text
nothing,
where there's a variation.
There's nothing in there that actually would justify the NASB's translation of as equal to.
Well, actually, if you look at the NIV and all the others, there's a whole host of translations of it, but the literal translation would be have counted it as the clay.
Right, right. Right.
And so the question then becomes, well, if you translate as clay, what do you mean?
Exactly. I mean,
so
is it equal?
That's where it's
is it like?
From. Right.
Is it, what is it?
Exactly.
What is it talking about? My point is that I kind of feel like, as members of the church, we certainly acknowledge that God is our creator, and we are as the clay to the potter in that respect. Absolutely, with respect to our bodies, certainly, we're created by God and are strictly the clay. But as to whether or not that denies equality with God, I would say it's not clear, and that we may be stretching the analogy a bit much. I mean, it just seemed to me that you were stretching the analogy a bit far.
Well, and we went over it, but I believe that the fundamental point of that passage, Psalm 50 and numerous others I didn't even get to, is that Isaiah, or God actually, could remonstrate with these people and could rebuke them because it was a fundamental article of their belief concerning God that they were thinking of God as if he was like man, and he is not.
Now, you say that he is not.
Right.
And I understand that that's kind of a fundamental precept in your mind, that you have, and I would say Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, has had that opinion since approximately 150, no, let's see, no. Justin Martyr said it first in Dialogue with Trypho, a Jew. That was about 159 A.D. Prior to that, it appears nowhere in any writing that I'm familiar with, except possibly some of the versions of Ignatius, which are so numerous that nobody can tell what was the original thing he said.
I would not agree with that statement. But that's,
well, there are. I'm familiar with three different versions. I'm familiar with 15 letters that are supposed to be by him, seven of which are clearly not written by him, three of which appear in the Syriac and are believed to be accurate because they're also in the Syriac as well. But you compare the Syriac and you compare the Long and the Greek versions, and they're just vastly different with respect to their description of God.
I wouldn't agree with that either, but I would go with the Greek edition of the seven genuine epistles of Ignatius, not using the pseudo-Ignatian epistles at all, and what they present concerning God is
which versions, Long or Short Greek?
Well, there's only one, the Greek, if you're referring to the longer version, that's primarily based on Latin, not on Greek.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay,
it's
so
a much older version, probably.
The,
I mean,
Greek,
it was older, and therefore more likely suspect to having been fiddled with by people who are trying to make, in the... Are you familiar with the history of the second century?
Yes, I teach church history.
Yeah, good. But what about Roman history?
Well, not Roman history outside of its relevance to the interaction between the leaders, the Roman leaders, and the Christian church.
Right. So you're familiar with the fact that there was a long peace following the death of Trajan
mm-hmm.
from 117 A.D. to approximately 163. No, probably 161, that's when...
there was only local persecution during that time.
Right, and there was criticism, extensive criticism, on three principal points. the most important of which was atheism.
Mm-hmm. Denied the existence of the Roman gods.
Right. Well, not just the Roman gods. Do you know...
Well, any gods, but the one true God.
Right, right. In other words, what was the problem was that the Christians were worshiping a god that just did not fit in with the Roman idea of what God should be, or the ideas or views of the Greek philosophers, which were accepted generally by the pagan culture at the time. In fact, those were the opinions of the intellectual elite at the time. They taught a god that basically was completely different from man. And in fact, I submit to you that that is the source of your view on that.
Actually, the Greeks had gods who were plurality of gods. They believed that these gods had physical bodies. And
You're talking about the pagans.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, no, I'm not talking about the pagans. Exactly. I'm talking about the prevailing Hellenistic view.
I'm not talking about the Greeks.
Yes, I'm talking about the prevailing Hellenistic view of the Greeks as of the at the time of Christ. Mm-hmm. It was the intellectuals. I mean, yes, the majority of the masses that had no really strong influence on thought, frankly. At that time, they did not. Most were pagans, but their ideas of what God was like were very much criticized by the
There were all sorts of different views at the time. I would not say, however, you say there's nothing before that. That's why I presented in Is the Mormon My Brother and in Letters to a Mormon Elder the testimony of the scriptures in regards to the nature of God.
That's
and
very
I
important.
And I recognize that in your book you assert and basically make it a mantra a number of times, Hellenistic Christians. I do not believe for a second that what divides us is due to Greek philosophy.
My new book that's coming out shortly, I think, will demonstrate, unfortunately, I wish it was out now. And
I wish this was out right now. It's my book, The Forgotten Truth.
Well, I appreciate the chapters you gave me. And by the way, I must say that your exegesis of John 1:1 was superb.
Which we need to discuss concerning your book.
I think we need to discuss it concerning what the truth is, but,
You made some direct assertions in Biblical Mormonism that John 1:1 teaches that Jesus is created, and I think we need to look at the text and see if that's the case, as well as in Colossians 1, but...
We'll get to that.
Do you want to focus on this one special thing that we do need to get into is defining the doctrine of the Trinity correctly?
Absolutely. I'm very anxious to get to that, and I will do that I'm leading into that. But
okay.
Are you familiar with the idea of strict monotheism that characterized, in fact, monotheism, for example, is not a word that appears in the Bible, is it?
No, it's not.
No, so no inspired writer used monotheism to describe the Jewish...
Or polytheism, or henotheism,
exactly,
or panentheism, or anything like that. No,
exactly.
No, they said, Shema Yisrael, Yahweh Eloheinu, Yahweh Echad.
Yeah.
Hear, O Israel, Yahweh our Elohim, Yahweh is one.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. And so they believed in one God. But
Yahweh Elohim.
Yahweh Elohim.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Well, see, because if you were listening in the previous...
I was listening.
Okay, so you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we don't need to go over the old stuff.
What I meant was when I presented the distinction between Elohim and Yahweh and the identification of Jesus as Yahweh, which you do present plainly.
Yes.
I was told that that's not exactly the view. So
yes,
I'm just,
well,
I want to make sure we're going on the same railroad track.
I can't speak for every Mormon in the...
I understand that. I'm not asking you to. I just want to make sure
I
get yours.
I think my view on this is the prevailing view amongst Mormons.
I would agree that it is. It's just that some will argue that it's a 20th century identification and not a 19th century identification because Joseph Smith did identify the Father as Jehovah, which he did. So, but I would say that today, the 1916 statement of the doctrinal exposition of the First Presidency on the relationship of the Father and the Son should be the doctrinal norm by which we go in describing quote-unquote Mormonism.
I don't believe Joseph Smith identified the Father as Jehovah. There were some statements he made early on, though, very, very early on, before, I would say, before his understanding of God became more complete, that can be confusing to you. But I think there's very little that is in that area.
Okay.
No, Now, my point, though, is this. Are you familiar with the writings, say, of Pythagoras?
Mm-hmm.
Good. So you know that Pythagoras started a group called the Pythagoreans, and he observed in the mathematics by which he calculated the orbits of planets and stars and so forth, that there was this perfect order in the heavens, mm-hmm. which convinced all the Greek philosophers after him that there was absolutely one being who was God. And, that's right, isn't it?
Well, I think that would be a very simplistic view of what would be presented by someone like Philo, someone that would be presented by any of the great Greek philosophers.
Philo never disagreed with Pythagoras as far as the number of gods.
You've got Plato's view, you've got Neoplatonism, their view of the Logos. I mean, there's all sorts of issues that go in here. You can't just simply... Now, interestingly enough, someone like Justin, who was more of a philosopher than he was a theologian, by far, he wore the pallium his entire life, saw in these Greek teachers... elements of God's truth. Look, they've found God's truth by just simple reference to looking at the world around them.
No, he and Clement of Alexandria both claimed that the Greek philosophers had stolen a number of their views from the Hebrew prophets, who, as he pointed out, wrote before the Greek philosophers.
But they also felt that just by the observation, like Pythagoras did, of mathematics, the world around them, so on and so forth.
Oh, yes.
They could see this perfection.
Right.
So, but the issue
is... It is interesting to me that Pythagoras, in around 600 B.C., was living right around the time Isaiah prophesied that the Gentiles would... that the time of the Gentiles would come in. That basically the Messiah would be rejected and the gospel would go sort of be taken over by the Gentiles.
You'll find me to agree primarily with Tertullian when he said, what does Jerusalem have to do with Athens? Personally, that's
James Scheele are in the same,
same
bent on that. I find there to be a number of interesting doctrines taught by the ancient Greeks that correlate so closely with LDS beliefs in certain ways that I cannot help but believe that they did in fact take some of their ideas from the Jews, the ancient Jews. But that's not the point that I'm trying to get to. The point is that as philosophy progressed, by the time of Christ, the Platonists were teaching, basically, that God is matter, God is mind, and everything else, matter, that is matter, is created and is distinct from that which is mind. This is dualism, as I'm sure you're familiar with. I noticed your use of it. I wouldn't agree with this. I mean, there were some groups that who identified the mind as the only good thing and the matter as evil, but that wasn't the general vein of it. It was both. Dualism is basically a belief in a distinction between mind and matter. Whereas,
Gnostic dualism included the specific.
Oh, yes. Gnostic dualism definitely did that.
And it's proto-Gnostic dualism that Paul is dealing with, I believe, in Colossians, which is where I presented that in the chapters.
Yes. Yes. And we can get into that. But my point is that. It's my position, and you'll need to read my book for this, that
the new book.
Yeah, the new one. That these views became the founding assumptions of the apologists, which they brought in to early Christianity and changed in very many subtle ways that became very important distinctions. The way that they looked at the scriptures, the way that classical theism to this day interpret scripture. So when we go through this, I want to try and identify, if I can, the areas where I think that your interpretation is coming from Greek philosophy as opposed, or a Greek assumption that I can easily trace and do in my book to extensive, statements by the Greek philosophers and so forth of the time and of, and earlier, that agree with it, whereas there's nothing in the Bible that says anything about that. And to me, that leads to a clear assumption, a clear conclusion, that what you're assuming when you think about the scriptures from a Greek perspective is not accurate. I mean, the Greek scriptures were not given to Greeks. The Greek scriptures were given to Hebrews. You got to think like a Hebrew.
Yeah. In fact, that's the very point I make, and is more my brother, is that I rebut Dr. Robinson's assertion that the differences between us are, do come from Greek philosophy, but pointing out the difference isn't Greek philosophy, it's the Shema. It is the Old Testament presentation of the supremacy of Yahweh, the nature of Yahweh, and the relationship of Yahweh to the creation.
Okay,
and so
let's get to that,
yeah,
because I think that's an important thing, place to start. We're talking about, let's talk about the Trinity.
And let's do that.
You've given me, in your in the letter you sent, a very excellent three foundations to the Trinity.
Exactly.
And I think we ought to go over those, because I will tell you something amazing that you will find, and that is that Mormonism actually does not disagree with you on any of those foundations.
Actually, Mormonism fundamentally disagrees with me on the first. Well, that's the issue. But before we do that, I just have to point out, and I hope we have the time to do this, is that I hope in your new book, I've listed here about 8 places where your work very clearly, and I mentioned this in the letter. Do we need to go to a break right now?
I think we're having to go to a break. My engineer is indicating we need to go to a break.
Well, the engineer is always in control. He has all power.
He is, so we're going to have to do that. And well, let's get back to what you're going to say as soon as we do that. Hello, this is Richard Hopkins. We're returning with Religion Today. And in studio, we have James White and his son, who, by the way, is here with him. A young man, looks like a fine young fellow. What's his name, James?
Joshua?
Nice to have you, Joshua.
This is actually his third general conference to come up here.
Oh, how nice. Joshua, you should listen to them sometime. Okay. I have my son in studio, too. He's the engineer, by the way, who is telling us we have to go. All right. You know, this is really the toughest thing for me to get across to evangelical or Orthodox Christians, that Mormons do in fact believe in one God. And I'm hoping that when you read my book, you'll understand just how exactly true that is and how much we really do believe in one God. The thing that gets you guys mistaken is the exact same thing that got the Arians off and going crazy, is that the New Testament talks about more than one God. So how do you figure, you know, Old Testament, one God, well, whatever, it talks about more than one individual whose title is God.
That's where Mr. Hopkins, with all due respect, you do not understand what the doctrine of the Trinity, as taught by the Nicene Creed, as you cite it, is. And let me give you an example on page 69. You say, he is not three gods in one essence, a Trinity. We don't believe he's three gods in one essence. On page 79, the New Testament is always clear in treating the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost as separate persons. How could Christ also be God the Father in the Nicene sense? The Nicene Creed and Trinitarians deny vehemently that the Father is the Son. They would never say that. In fact, they anathematized anyone who would say that. So everything on 79 is incorrect. Page 81. If the Father and the Son are the same way, are the same in the way the Nicene Creed describes, why did one raise the other from the dead? That's not what the Nicene Creed says at all. All through here. Page 87, the analysis only shows how erroneous Nicene doctrine is. The Greek word character refers to an exact reproduction, not the original. We're not saying that he's the Father. Page 90, 93, 94, 95. And realize, you said this in the context of calling it a heresy and calling others cultists who believe it. That is not what the doctrine of the Trinity states. You cited the Athanasian Creed that says we do not confound the person. And you did indicate at one point anyways, you were struggling with it anyways, you reject the idea that you can differentiate between being and person. You say it's incomprehensible, it's incongruent. And yet, as you sit there right now, you're doing it.
Oh, how am I doing that? I'm interested.
There's a microphone right in front of you, right?
Yeah, right.
Would you ever get as close to me and talking to me as you are to that microphone?
No.
And I wouldn't to you. We Americans don't like to get that close to each other because that's far too close for us. Are you worried about offending the microphone?
Nope. I'm worried about offending my audience.
Okay, but if you
chomp or talk.
Okay, exactly. Let's say though you came in and we all had dinner beforehand and we stopped at Fazoli's Italian restaurant and we had garlic bread. All of us did, and we had to rush in here and didn't have a chance to do anything about it. You wouldn't be worried about offending that microphone, would you?
Nope.
Why? Because the microphone has being, it exists, but it is not personal. It is not a person. It cannot be offended. Mm-hmm. The doctrine of the Trinity says there is one being of God, infinite and eternal, not limited by time or space, that the Bible identifies by the word Jehovah. But it is shared by three co-equal and co-eternal persons, the Father, the Son, the Spirit. Being does not mean person. The Father loves the Son and sent the Son. The Son and the Father send the Spirit. They are not one person, as you say throughout your book. Three persons, but see, you and I are human beings. My being is limited to, I believe the time is approximately 18 minutes before 8 on, what is today, April, is today the 6th? April 6th, 1998 in Salt Lake City, Utah. I am not at a different time in a different place. Star Trek aside, I can't do that. My being is limited and finite because I'm a creature. And my being is shared by one person, James. Your being is shared by one person, Richard. Joshua's being is shared by one person, Joshua. Only my being, since it's limited, can only be shared by one person. God's being, which is unlimited, is shared biblically by three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. So this is demonstrated biblically for us by the fact that the word Jehovah, as you would agree, is used of the Son. I don't know that you would agree that it's used of the Father, but it is in Isaiah 53:6 and Matthew chapter 22.
Really, so it really makes no difference.
Okay.
It makes no difference which member of the Godhead is speaking for that singular authority which we believe rules the universe and which you refer to and which is you referred to, as you pointed out, with a rather qualitative word, theos, that reflects divine nature. And it for us would be the singular authority that comes from the Father, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 8:6.
But the one being that we believe is described by the name Jehovah But I'm just trying to point out to you that all of these objections that you presented in your book are relevant only to a small group of people called Oneness Pentecostals, if you've ever run into them, the Jesus-only movement.
All right, I'd like to get off of that point because I don't think that you understand the perspective from which I'm coming to in the book. Let's try and get to that so you understand why I do not agree that you can simply... See, what your problem is this. You've got three people clearly described separately every single time in the New Testament that they're referred to. They speak as I... Thou.
Which is exactly so, when I see it taught.
Yeah, exactly. And yet you want
but
to impose
your book, you
on
say
them.
That's
no,
not
no,
what
no,
they
no. Please, James, wait, let me finish now. I let you talk.
Okay.
You want, well, not you, classical theism, and classical theism wants to do this because the apologists did it, and the apologists did it because the Greeks did it from the time of Pythagoras. They want to take...
I completely disagree.
Fine, I know you disagree, okay. But at any rate... You want to take these three separate individuals, and instead of seeing them as a singular authority, seeing the three of them as a singular position that flows from the Father and is exercised by the Son and the Holy Ghost, you want to make them one being. Now, that's where all we disagree on. We agree with all the other three things. Yes, there is only one God. Yes, there are three divine persons.
No.
Yes, they are co-equal and eternal. But we disagree on whether or not there is a being here that is a singular being. Now, what we say instead is there's another explanation for these three foundations, and you haven't got it. It appears in the Bible. It appears with the throughout the Old Testament, the referral to Jehovah frequently as the angel of God, the fact that angels are agents of God, the fact that Christ submitted his will to God while he was here upon earth, to the Father. And what that indicates, if you put those together, is you're not talking about a single being. What we're talking about is a single authority. The authority of the Father that is exercised by those who sit on his throne with him. Revelations, I think it's 3:21. So that is my point on this, that we disagree. It is not as big a disagreement as you may think. It comes out as a huge disagreement.
No, it is a huge disagreement. It's a fundamental disagreement because right. You're also saying that quote-unquote authority, that there are other gods, the God is once a man lived on another planet, the king followed funeral discourse.
I quote Paul, to us there is but one God, the Father.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
That's not all he says.
No.
He defines that
then
one God as the Father and the Son.
No, yeah, but the point is he says there is one God, then he names two different people.
That's
What's
right.
the point? The point is that the one God is the Father from whom the source, but he says from whom are all things,
mm-hmm.
meaning including clearly what he's talking about, a divinity and the idea of the singular authority that he's talking about.
He never uses the term exousia of God.
Well,
he never says God is an exousia.
Well, why, where did you get exousia?
That's authority.
I didn't mention that.
You're saying authority. I'm just taking it back into Paul's language.
No, he does not use that word. He uses the word God.
So he doesn't use the term authority?
No, because the authority he's talking about is divine.
Okay.
It's much higher than what you would use to describe an earthly authority.
And so when he speaks of God, you're saying he's only speaking of an authority. Mm-hmm. He's not speaking of Yahweh of the Old Testament.
No, he's speaking of the Father, whose authority as God is exercised by the Son in the Old Testament and in the New Testament to a certain extent. But you're familiar with the kenosis, right?
Of course.
All right. We'll get to that a little bit later. But the point is that the authority is what's being dealt with here. That's what is singular, is that the authority.
No, the authority is God, and he does not identify God as exousia or authority.
Well,
God is the being of God. That is what we do believe, that there is only one true God.
Yeah, and the idea that you're seeing here is that there is only one...
being of God.
Being.
Shared by three persons.
Where is that in the Bible?
The
term, there's only one being of God.
Shema Yisrael, Yahweh Elohim, Yahweh
no,
Echad.
No, that... that can clearly
before
be
me
understood.
There is no God for him, there should be none after me. Is there any other God besides me? There is no rock, I know not any.
He is speaking as the... when John was getting the revelation that he recorded in Revelation, the book of Revelation, he was being spoken to in the first person by God, supposedly, all the way along.
Okay.
All of a sudden, in chapter 19, he bows down to worship this being who he believes to be God because he's speaking in the first person as God. And the angel, turns out to be an angel, says, wait, I'm not God. I'm your fellow servant. You worship God. Lifts
him
up.
Worship God alone.
Right, exactly. And so he goes on then, speaking again, just as if you were God in the first person. My point is that Jehovah has done that throughout the Old Testament, and anybody like Jehovah, the Father, and the Holy Ghost would do that because they represent a singular authority. And I'm not talking about an earthly authority for which he would use the Greek word. I'm talking about the ultimate authority, deity, God. That's the only authority.
Where is theos ever defined in any lexical form that I'm aware of as ultimate authority?
Oh, all the if Unibley had made a lexicon for us, it would be there.
well, that said a whole lot more than you may have wanted to intend to say at that
no,
particular
no, no,
point.
No. My point is this. All the lexicons that I'm familiar with, I use Thayer and Bauer both. And both of those lexicons are written by, although Bauer is pretty far off the classical theist edge in some respects, and frankly, I like his lexicon best, but they're both classical theists, and so you will not find their definition.
So you're saying they're unfair?
I'm just saying that their definition of the terms is frequently and quite obviously, at least to me anyway, shaded by their view of the word they're trying to express a definition of.
You said on page 94, if the Father and the Son were a singularity, as taught in Nicene doctrine, there could be no separation of authority between them, with one subjection to the other, as Paul unequivocally taught.
Right, and my point is exactly that. What you say there's one being, that's a singularity. You're talking Pythagoras here.
No.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
that's
talking
where it
Yahweh.
Comes from. No, because Yahweh was identified with Yahweh Elohim. Elohim is plural. The Jews always knew there was a plurality involved there. Or at least they should have. They should have paid attention to it. And if you don't believe me, read Justin Martyr. I mean, Justin Martyr extensively points out that the three were taught from the very beginning of the
Bible. And he identifies Jesus and the Father as Jehovah. But where does Nicene doctrine, Mr. Hopkins, teach that the Father and the Son are a singularity so that there is no subjection of the Son to the Father? The Nicene doctrine never, ever teaches that.
James, look, you want to have your cake and eat it too with the Nicene doctrine, and that's what the classical theists have done since the time of Irenaeus and Anaxagoras when they first came out with this idea. And the fact of the matter is that you cannot just say, hey, look, there are three persons here, but they're really only one person.
I didn't say that. Exactly right. Nicaea has never said that.
Okay, what did they say? The one being? What's the difference?
I hope you can grasp this before your book goes to print, because any Trinitarian is going to say, what you're saying is like my saying that Mormons worship Joseph Smith. That is the level of error of your criticism.
I understand that you want that to be the case. Wait a minute, James, let me go over this, because you've got to, if it's different from this, you need to explain a lot. So let's get it clear what the problem is here. The problem is you have three separate persons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me ask you this. Do these persons have a separate center of consciousness? Do each of the three have a separate center of consciousness?
Using the quotation from Dr. Moore, yes.
Well, I don't know about Moore.
I think that's what you quote in your book.
Well, my point is this. Do they have a separate center of consciousness?
Each says, I and you, well, the Father loves the Son, right. The Son loves the Father.
Okay. Do
yes.
they share the same knowledge?
Yes, actually they do.
Well, the Bible doesn't say that.
I know what you're referring to. We're talking about Jesus Christ in the incarnation.
Yep. Let me just get to this. I appreciate
the kenosis, remember?
Well, more than that. I appreciate you being honest about saying that, because otherwise you're denying Arrhenius, who said clearly the mind and he believes.
I'm not concerned about that. I'm concerned about biblical teaching, and I'm not concerned about the early fathers. And I know that you want to say that's all my beliefs are, but they are not.
Well, let's get this clear.
You need to get this clear.
I'm
because
very close
this,
to.
This statement, when you say that Nicaea teaches that three persons are one person, you are wrong.
Okay, now let me just tell you that I am not wrong in my view of what you are saying. Now, let's go to, if you can change the view of what we are saying here, so that in fact, all right, let's get to this now. You say that the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost share the same knowledge, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Do they have the same will?
The will?
Yeah.
There's one will of God, yes.
Okay, so how come it says, how come Christ says, not my will, but thine be done?
Because he became incarnate as a man. And as a man, he had a human will.
So the human will.
In other words, I'm avoiding the error of monothelitism.
Okay, wait a minute. So the will of Christ was only manifest in his human nature, is that correct?
In that sense, yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, when he became resurrected...
In the quote you gave, my will, but thine be done.
Okay, so in other words, only for 33 years he had a will separate from the Father's.
In that sense, yes, a human will, yes.
Okay, so...
In the passage you cited.
Uh-huh, as human will. Well, what's the difference? What kind
well,
of will
Well, because obviously in Philippians chapter 2, when Jesus becomes incarnate, he does so voluntarily. It was his will, his desire to enter into human flesh. It says he made himself of no repute. It's reflexive. He did this himself.
Yeah, but
it was not done to him.
Wait a minute.
This was his eternal purpose to do so.
Of course. I mean, but it was a purpose of God, and it was the fact that he was willing to do this that God foreknew when he exalted him, as it says in Philippians 2:9.
What do you mean he foreknew that he was willing to do this?
He foreknew that he was willing to shed his position in what we would call the Godhead, what you call the Trinity.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't his position. It was his position of glory with the Father, which he had before the world began.
Right. That's what I'm talking about.
He existed in the morphe tu theou. But the point is,
he was willing to shed that.
Your constant accusation against the Nicene doctrine, the Trinity, is that that passage differentiates
right.
between the Father and the Son.
We all believe that. James, this is my problem. This is my point. The problem is this. I deny that you are sincere in believing in their separation when you turn around and say they are the same person, they have the
we
same
do not say they're the same person,
oh,
Mr.
All right,
Hopkins.
All right, wait a minute. You see, the problem is this. Persona is a word taken from the Latin that was decided upon to use to mean a certain thing. But
Latin
what is
later.
A person?
Latin came later.
Yes, I know that. It was used to translate, which is it? Hypostasis?
Well, that's the whole issue. There was a tremendous disagreement
right.
between the Greek-speaking and the Latin-speaking fathers because they were miscommunicating.
Exactly.
But the Nicene faith is that there is one ousia of God shared by three persons, the Father, the Son, the Spirit. These are not human persons with a physical body. They are persons who love, who act, and who have interaction with one another,
wait a minute,
and it
wait
is
a minute.
Not...
They don't have a physical body?
No, they do not.
Then you deny the physical resurrection of Christ.
I do not at all.
Well, then one of them's got a physical body now, right?
Jesus, in eternity past, they are not limited to physical bodies. At the incarnation,
why do you count
the
that
Son...
as a limitation?
At the incarnation of the Son, he took on human flesh and continues to have that glorified body to this day.
Okay,
but
good.
It was
one
not something
physical body.
Was not something that he had in eternity and is not definitional of the persons of the Trinity.
Well, Mormons
you may
do
disagree.
Not believe that, wait a minute. No. Mormons do not believe he had a physical body for eternity.
I realize that.
Okay, so we're...
He went through mortal probation to obtain his physical body.
We believe he started out as an intelligence.
And then became a spirit child.
Received a spirit body.
Yes, I know.
Then received a physical body. Then the physical body was resurrected, so it's permanent.
The difference, Mr. Hopkins, is that when I write in Is the Mormon My Brother,
mm-hmm.
I cite from the general authorities of the LDS Church, and I believe accurately define what Mormonism teaches from a Mormon perspective. I'm simply trying to communicate to you that the assertions that you're making in Biblical Mormonism about Nicene Orthodoxy oneness Pentecostalism, Nicene faith.
No, it is, but let me go to the point. What is your idea of what a person is?
The Nicene faith is talking about the persons of the Godhead.
Yes, and what are they?
They're talking about the Father and the Son and the Spirit, each who is co-equal and co-eternal, but who is not to be confused with the other, that are differentiated in Scripture. They have communication with one another.
All that we agree with.
They love one another.
Got that. It's all, you're absolutely right. That's all in the Bible.
Exactly.
Right.
And so,
now, where do you get
to
in the
accuse
Bible
Nicene Orthodoxy of not believing that?
No.
One God, Yahweh, who has eternally been God. Psalm
absolutely.
90, verse 2.
I agree with you on that.
He has eternally been God.
We agree on that, too.
He's never a man.
Well, no, I don't. We don't.
Well, but then,
that.
Then, your words, eternally been God, are not the way we understand eternally been God. He has been God in any eternity, any creation, any universe you wish to postulate. He's always been God.
Well, you know, that would be really interesting if you could find that. And I know that you think Paul says that.
And I believe it in Psalm 90, verse 2.
Well, Psalm 90, verse 2 is even less specific. It uses Olam for eternity.
So?
Well, Olam is indistinct as to time period.
Not at all.
Well, then you disagree with one of the lexicons. I think Bauer. No, it's Jesenius, of course.
Depends on its usage and its context, sir. Oh, yes, it does.
Well,
do you teach the subject?
Would it matter if I?
It would if you're saying
the subject. If you think I don't know it because I don't teach it.
If you're saying that you can correct Jesenius, then I would have to ask you upon what basis you're making
it. I'm not correcting Jesenius. I'm using Jesenius.
And you are saying that he does not indicate that this is contextually defined?
I can get it out. We have to go to a break here. When we're out, I'll be happy to get Jesenius out, and we'll see what he says on the subject. Hello, folks. Richard Hopkins, we're returning now with James White. We appreciate you being here. We're talking about... we were going to talk about Jesenius, but I'm not sure that that's really the issue here. What we're trying to do is communicate on a point that is quite important to James, and I think it's quite important to this dialogue, and maybe what we need to do is focus on that issue just a bit more. Just as Mormons do not like to be misunderstood as to what they are actually teaching, James is objecting to my conclusions based upon what I regard to be a failure of the Trinity doctrine to explain how what we're talking about with respect to three persons in one being.
May I quote you?
Yeah. Well, you know what?
You like to be quoted, don't you?
I learn as much as anybody else does, and things that I say one point in time, I may not quite word them the same way at the next point in time.
And I don't have any problem with that, because I have no problem with that, and if you want to say that this is not representative of where you are right now, please tell me. Because I have no way of knowing outside of your telling me that. I have to go with what's there.
Yeah.
You said on page 70, the Trinity, and I'm sorry, let me back up. That question racked and split the early church during the 3rd and 4th centuries A.D. The answer that became historical Christian orthodoxy was the seminal step into an apostasy that has influenced Christian churches of the present era. The Trinity, an incomprehensible conglomeration of the three into one substance, essence, or nature, co-substantial, co-equal, and co-eternal, remains one of the most telling legacies of that apostasy in Christianity today. Mormons reject this concept as an early heresy and insist that references to God's oneness were not meant to be interpreted in a mechanically literal sense, but in a more figurative sense, is consistent with all the relevant passages in the Bible and with common sense. And you specifically said on page 71, in the heyday of Greek philosophy, man's intellect generated the ultimate idol, which I guess you're referring to the Trinity. A completely inscrutable paradox, the false concept of God known as the Trinity transcends both substance and comprehension. I am simply, my main point, and it's one point is very clear, and that is the passages that I read from 69, 79, 81, 87, 90, 93, 94, 95 in your book are erroneous in the understanding of what the Nicene Creed states. The Nicene Creed refers to the Father, and it refers to the Son, not as the Father, but as the Son. It nowhere says that the Father is the Son. And so to say that the Nicene Creed says that three persons are one person is to misrepresent it. Now, when I write on Mormonism, and I invite you, you may not have seen the book before, as Van liked to point out, no one ever will, but actually it's doing rather well. And as I've given you a copy of Is the Mormon My Brother? And Letters to a Mormon Elder, I would invite you to hold me to the same standard of accuracy in representing Mormonism that I am asking you to hold yourself to. And that is to recognize that we do not say that the Father is the Son. We recognize that the Son became incarnate. It was not the Father who became incarnate. It was not the Spirit who became incarnate. It was the Son who became incarnate. That the Son takes a different function and role in our redemption than the Father does, and that the Spirit does.
All this is good, James, and I'm well aware of the position of and the doctrine of co-substantiality that became or that was discussed, shall we say, at Nicaea, because in fact it did not have its origin at Nicaea, as you pointed out.
That's quite true.
You're
talking about the homoousion clause,
right? All of that. All of that doctrine had its origin from about 160 to 180 A.D. in the Apologists. If you follow the writings of the early Christian fathers, you'll find that's when that developed.
Let me point out an error, please.
Okay.
Are you aware of the fact that there were three different groups at Nicaea? In fact,
yes.
I wrote an article.
I'm well aware of it.
Okay, I wrote an article for the CRI Journal recently called
the third group, the ones that were
middle of the road.
Middle of the road. The Homoousians, actually.
Homoousios.
You're right. Well, they were actually Homoousians, according to the records that I've studied on.
They're a subgroup, but they resisted initially the use of the term Homoousios, of the same substance of the Father.
Mm-hmm.
You know why they resisted it?
If you want to tell me, I'll listen.
Okay. This is where the term really has interest, because you address this in your book. But the reason many of the Eastern bishops did not want to use the term homoousios is because it had been condemned at a synod in the middle of the 3rd century, because the Sabellians, the modalists, those who did say that the Father and the Son were one person, were using the term. And they
yes,
were concerned that by using it, they were going to be giving comfort to those who were denying that the Father and the Son are separate persons.
I'm quite aware of it. There was a big hullabaloo between Dionysius of Alexandria and Dionysius of Rome over this problem. And that, to me, is beside the point. The point is this. We agree with you that the three are separate persons. But we do not agree with you on, and this is the only element of our disagreement, is we believe in one God the same as you do. We believe there are three separate persons the same as you do.
No.
What we do not believe is that there is some mystical way that these three persons are a singular being is the way to explain those two facts. There are two foundations that you mention in here. One of them is that God, there is only one God. We agree with that. But we view that as an authority situation.
Right, and that's where we totally disagree.
The words don't mean the same thing. Well,
to say we agree is to say that the Republicans and the Democrats can agree on a bill when they come up with language that means one thing to a Democrat and another thing to a Republican.
Fine. The point is this. I agree with you. We don't agree on how do you explain these two facts. How do you explain the fact that the Bible teaches there's one God? And how do you explain that the New Testament teaches there's one God and also identifies three individuals?
Right.
Okay, so how do you explain that, all right? That's the issue. That took the church hundreds of years to deal with and to deal with some of the heresies. Actually, it took 20 years for them to come up with the explanation that was adopted at Nicaea. But be that as it may, the point
is... I'm sorry, I didn't understand what you just
said.
Well,
between about 160 and 180 A.D. is when they came up with the... co-substantiality explanation of it. Read my book and check the authorities at that time.
I'm more than glad to do so, especially since you can find Trinitarian passages in Ignatius, but that's okay.
There are some versions of Ignatius that have very Greek metaphysical types of...
No, but in the oldest, the ones that scholars agree go back to Ignatius himself, He is very, very plain in proclaiming the deity of Christ, the full deity of Christ. There are Trinitarian passages in him in that sense.
We're getting some frustrated people who want to get on the air. And
those people staying outside the door with the guns, those guys? You didn't see them during the break,
did
you?
I didn't see those.
Oh, okay.
Okay, just, all right. I'm going to get to that in just at quarter after the hour, so you got two more minutes, and then I'll be taking calls. All right. This is. I'm reading from you. The problem is, of course, this is your explanation that you sent to me about the Trinity. The problem is, of course, you recognize immediately that you say that we're not going to be able to explain God fully because we don't understand. We're on a different plane. We're completely different from God, and God is completely unique.
Are you reading from one of my chapters in my letter to you?
No, I'm. Yes, one of the. Well, this is one of your chapters.
Okay.
That you sent. It says. The problem is, of course, God is completely unique. He is God, and there is no other. He is totally unlike anything else.
That's what holiness means, in fact.
Well, I don't agree with you on that, but be that as it may, he's totally unlike anything else. I'm sorry, I find that to be completely unbiblical. How
that
can
is,
you say that in that the face of Genesis 1, 26 and 27?
Because similarities do not make equality.
What do you mean similarities?
Same thing I mentioned
Let me finish this. Well, no, wait, let me finish this. In Genesis 5:3, Moses, the same writer, says that Adam had a son in his image and likeness, Seth. Same exact words.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you are telling me that God is something completely different from man, and yet he made man in his image and likeness, just like Seth was in the image and likeness of Adam.
Mm-hmm.
How do you get to that? What
belief of God? Because God creates; he does not beget.
What is create and beget? What are you talking about? What difference is this? Where is that in the Bible?
That's in the Old Testament.
Where?
That's all through the Old Testament.
Where?
Well, for example, God created Adam. Adam begat Seth.
It says in Luke 3:38 that Adam is the son of God.
But it does not say begat.
All right. I'm not sure you're assuming that creation means to create out of nothing. Is that correct?
Well, certainly in passages, again, I don't know how much you heard of my discussion with Van, but there are numerous passages I alluded to there that talk about the fact that he spread abroad the heavens by his understanding, by his wisdom he created that which did not exist.
Right, and a scientist creates by his wisdom things that didn't previously exist,
like a stereo or something. No, I do not believe that.
Well, that's what your opinion is of the word, but are you aware of the origin of the doctrine of creation out of nothing?
I'm aware of what you probably think it is.
Well, I know that Justin Martyr did not teach it. And before Justin Martyr, the first time it was taught was by Basilides, who was a Gnostic heretic. And then it was taken up by Tatian, who became a Gnostic heretic. And then it was adopted by the apologists. So you tell me where the origin was, if it wasn't from other sources than the Bible.
It's called the Old Testament when the Bible describes the creative work of God. And that is another thing that separates God from man, is that as we were pointing out in that passage and in many other passages, God creates the spirits of men. Joseph Smith said that he could not do that. Zechariah 12:1 says Jehovah creates the spirits of men. Mormonism says he is one of the spirits of men. That is just one of the many places where God's creative action is inconsistent with any type of idea where he actually is a part of matter or is simply organizing matter. It simply makes no sense at all.
Well, your assumption that it makes no sense is based entirely on Greek philosophy.
No, it's based entirely on the presentation of who Yahweh is.
No, it in fact doesn't. You have to approach that with a certain set of assumptions, and the assumptions that you have when you approach those passages are taken from the Greek philosophy.
And your assumptions come from Joseph Smith.
No, they come from Hebrew thinking.
I don't believe that Joseph Smith knew Hebrew
well,
thinking.
Well, we agree, we disagree. Let's go to the first caller here, which is line 3. Hello, Jean, you're on the air.
I've forgotten your name. The other fellow is James White.
Yes, I'm Richard Hopkins. Please don't forget my name. I wrote a nice book called Biblical Mormonism you might be interested in, and another one's coming out called How Greek Philosophy Corrupted the Christian Concept of God. So.
The Book of Mormon goes along pretty well with the Bible on how certain groups get into apostasy and what they're doing. Both of them prophesy about that. What I'm calling about is, I agree with you that he didn't create things out of nothing, and Jews will tell you that the creation stories in the Bible, which aren't the same in the first and second chapter.
By the way, the guy you like, Tertullian, James, he agreed with me on this. He didn't believe that God made...
So he believed that matter was eternal?
No, he did not believe that God was
eternal. Who are we talking about now as I'm trying to talk to the guest?
After we're talking about Tertullian. Go ahead, Gene.
All right. Now I've lost my train of thought because you came in, but on this stuff. But you've been discussing whether matter always exists, is what I'm hearing. My understanding is we have an eternal God, and every 7,000 years he puts in the earth into a new birth, called a new heaven and a new earth. It's reorganizing what's already there. And it's supposed to go back like in the time of Adam without having an Atlantic and a Pacific Ocean anymore.
Well, actually, Gene, that doctrine is very close to ancient Stoicism. The Stoics believed that there was a continual cycle ending where God...
Well, I'm talking about biblical prophecy. I'm not talking about any Stoicism.
I know that, but then perhaps you might not have it on quite right as far
but
as...
But you're not letting me talk to the guest at all. I'm trying to talk about his book.
Okay, what do you have to say about that, James?
Who, me?
No, I thought you wanted to talk with the guest.
Yeah, but the matter exists, but God reforms it and puts it in a new birth every 7,000 years, and that's biblical. That isn't something out of Stoicism.
Well, it's closer to Stoicism than it is to the Bible, Gene. I'm sorry to say that, but that's...
The Bible tells you in Revelation chapter 21, he's making a new heaven, new earth, and that's repeating Isaiah.
Oh, yes, he is making a new heavens and a new earth, and the earth shall pass away. That's true.
All right, and the way he does it is the mountains are flowing down, and the valleys are filling in, and
that's
there's no more water.
There's nothing in there that says that he's doing it every 7,000 years.
Yes, it does. It tells you exactly when he does it, after the 1,000-year millennium.
Exactly.
That's 7,000 years.
Yes, but my point is that he doesn't do the same thing over and over
every
7,000
years. Yes, he does do it the same thing over and over and over. He does it. It's written.
Okay.
It's his word.
All right. Let's hear what the guest has to say. Yes, let's do that. Go ahead. What do you think?
Well, I obviously disagree. I'm afraid that a very unusual thing has just happened. A caller has caused the two of us to agree with one another during this period of time. I don't know what to say.
It happens more than you
think. Well, I don't agree with him on everything, but I agree with him that the matter is shaped by God every so often. In fact, the creation's all through it. We have a flood. That's his creation there. And it goes on, and earth keeps altering, and volcanic eruption, and earthquake, and everything. It's never stopping. It's a continual cycle.
Well, I don't see... I will respond to that. The Bible says that there is a goal to history. There is a goal to what God is doing in Christ Jesus, and it does not give us any indication whatsoever that this is a cyclical type thing. In fact, it is the cross is identified as being the center point of history, the center point of time, and I see nothing in the Bible that would even begin to suggest to me that once he's finished this, he's just going to start a whole cycle all over again.
No, not
there's,
Jesus,
there's nothing
God.
In that in there in the Bible at all.
The word is from the mouth of God. Christ is the deliverer of the word. God is the creator, and Christ assists, and they're both called Alpha and Omega. And he's in the creation with the Father, and that's why it says God saying, let us make man.
Okay, Gene, thanks very much for your comments. We'll go now to Rich in Holiday.
Hello.
Rich, you're on the air.
Yes, I've got a question. Are either of...
Oops. Wait. Gene, are you on? Rich, hello?
Pushing button.
Rich?
Uh-oh.
Rich, hello?
Hello.
Oh, I'm sorry. We momentarily cut you off. Can you hold on one
second?
Well, no. Well, okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Are either of you familiar with an author, Max I. DeMont, Jews, God, and History?
I'm not. How about you? Okay. We're not.
Sorry.
Shoot. Well, okay. In that particular book, it's not necessarily a religious book, but it's more or less of a history, and he is in his particular circles recognized as a very eminent scholar. But he is Jewish, and his proclamation is that the Israelitish prophets drew as much from the philosophy of the Greeks as the Greeks did from the Jewish people.
I don't know how you demonstrate that historically, sir.
The Greeks the Jews were very much opposed to getting anything from the Greeks. The Greeks were Gentiles, Hellenes. That was translated the word Hellenes, which means derived from Hellenism. Let me just finish here. The word were the Gentiles, and they had the Greeks and others had made a lot of efforts to Hellenize the Jews, and that all stopped pretty much with Antiochus Epiphanes, who in 169 AD triggered the who were those fellows? The
Maccabees,
exactly. And the after the Maccabean revolt, the political groups that dominated Israel and Palestine pretty much let the Jews believe what they wanted to believe, and they did not have any Hellenistic views. For example, they were not believers in the metaphysical universe, and this is very, very important because most of the interpretation of scriptures that is done by classical theists today assumes the existence of a metaphysical universe with a being that exists outside of time and space. That was a Greek notion. It's not in the Bible.
Okay. Now, this question I think I would direct to Mr. White. Would you basically, and boy, I tell you, you boys are on some real refined doctrine here, and I want to stay just a little bit more general, or you'll throw me out of the ballpark.
Good deal.
But, Mr. White, are you of the opinion that that this God that you're talking about, 3-in-1, 1 or 3 or whatever, is he incomprehensible to a man's finite mind?
I believe that the God that I worship and that I love and that I serve and that Christians have worshipped and loved and served down through the centuries transcends my comprehension but not my understanding, and let me define my use of those terms. I can understand what the doctrine of the Trinity is. I can understand how being differs from person. I can understand what the Bible teaches about it. But I am a finite creature. I am a creation made by God. And as such, I cannot encompass with my mind a being who is infinite and eternal. So I think that is what you have in Isaiah 55 when God says, my ways are above your ways and my thoughts above your thoughts, is that my finite mind is incapable of really grasping. I can't even grasp the fact that he is eternal. I cannot think of eternity in its fullness, let alone more advanced revelations that God has made concerning his being. So historically, when the church has used the term incomprehensibility, what they are protecting is the uniqueness of God in the sense of not limiting him to the creation. And they're not saying that we cannot even begin to understand or define the truth that God has revealed about himself.
Richard, may I just jump in here for a second? I do think it's very interesting that we make a distinction, or that classical theists make a distinction, between things that are created and things that create. This is a Greek distinction. It existed long before Christ. It was taught by the Greek philosophers. And no, there's no biblical basis for it.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. There you have the beginning distinction between he who creates and that which is created.
That distinction
exists.
The
fundamental distinction in Romans 1 is between the creator and his creation.
There is a very distinct difference between man as a created being by God and God himself, but it does not extend to the inferiority of man and the fact that man is not, or the idea that man is not like God.
But your God is created.
Yes, and what's wrong with that?
So that's the whole idea.
No, see,
he becomes parallel with man then.
Well,
exactly.
Yes, my point is this. Exactly, he is the same. He is the genos. Man and God are the same species.
Well, listen, I know you've got more callers, but I've got, and there's another question that I would like to pop on the communicaster because it would blow things wide open, but we'll maybe save it for next time. But Mr. White, I heard an advertisement on this this radio station a couple of days ago, and apparently you are with the affiliated with the Southern Baptist Conference.
No.
You're not the one.
No, he's.
Where are you from?
I'm from Phoenix.
Do you have an address that I could send some correspondence to?
Sure, electronic or the old snail
mail? The old mail.
Oh, the old way, huh? Well, I have trouble getting the old way. But, I can give you an address there. Alpha and Omega Ministries, and it's Post Office Box 37106.
137?
No, 37106.
Okay.
Phoenix, Arizona, 85069.
If you need that later, we'll give it to you off the line.
I've got it.
Okay, great. We need to get to the next caller. Thanks very much for your contribution. Okay, I just wanted to mention before we go quickly that there is, in Mormon doctrine, there is no reason to think that the butterfly, that the caterpillar cannot become like the butterfly. Sure, the caterpillar is created, but eventually it can become the butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is that there's nothing, except in Greek theology, that discourages that attitude. There's nothing in the Bible that discourages that.
The Bible discourages Ezekiel's it tremendously.
Well, we'll have to have that discussion
later. Let me read you a biblical passage.
No, I can't do that right now.
Okay,
we've got
Romans
too many
1.
People waiting. Let me go to Scott in Salt Lake City. Scott, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'd like to ask a question of James White.
Please do.
I have several recordings of yours when the CLI broadcast used to come up here.
Well, it isn't up here anymore?
Oh, it hasn't been for about 3 years, since early, I think, 95. Not on KN, you know, it's not broadcast anymore up here.
Wow, that must have been a while back, because I've only been on with Hank since 95. I think it was the first time I came on the James Only thing.
And I got a lot of your information on that that I recorded, and then I also recorded your debate with one of the Catholic...
James Aiken?
Yes, okay. Yes, and I have those. It's among my prized collections to be able to listen to that material, you know, over and over again. But my question tonight, you about gave me a heart attack when you talked about the Lockman Foundation and your work with the Lockman Foundation. I didn't know that their work was ongoing, such as the work of the Revised Standard and the New Revised Standard is an ongoing board. I thought the Lockman Foundation, at least insofar as its work translating the Bible, had quit in 70, 71 when the New American Standard came out. So what I need to know is...
No, they're a well-kept secret.
What I need to know, you said you were working with them or helping them on something new where you jettisoned the thou and thy completely.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Is the work out yet?
Oh, yes. It's been out since 95.
And what's it called?
It's called the New American Standard Bible. Basically, it's New American Standard Bible update, but
it's just a later edition.
But what's going to happen is this edition will then supplant the 1977 edition, and as the copyrights of the 77 expire, then everybody will go to the new edition. Yeah.
So can I ask you about a number of formula things in it just for a minute, and then I'll get off the air?
I suppose.
You said it wasn't quite as wooden, and I would like something that was not as relaxed as the NIV, but something that was a little bit stiffer, and I would suppose that was maintained.
I'm laughing with Mr. Hopkins, because I felt like asking him sort of off-air, does Lockman have to pay for this time?
Yes,
a little unpaid advertising,
yes.
Send a bill or something like that.
No, I'm really excited about it. I mean, can I actually go to a Protestant bookstore and get this?
You know what, I would really love to have you have this discussion perhaps after we're off the air.
Can I give him, do you have access to the internet?
Well,
the reason I ask is that we make this translation available through our webpage.
It's on the internet.
And we make the translation available as far as being able to purchase the Bible. So I'd be glad to correspond with you if you got that address, or if you'd like to contact the webpage at www.aomin, that's aomin.org. Then I could sort of tell you some of the differences and why there are differences and why I think it'll fit exactly what you're looking for.
Well, and I think it will. For example, I was interested in the word abide, which is used a lot in the New American Standard in John 15 and in 1 John 2, 3, and 4, and 2 John. You still retain the term abide as often as you use it, or does it turn into remain as some of the other modern versions do. Remain seems a little more comfortable, and I just like it better as a word. I realize the translations are equally valid, but...
Actually, I'm looking at 15.6. It says, if anyone does not abide in...
Oh, so you retain.
It says abide. Basically, just very briefly, because I know Mr. Hopkins wants to move
the
on...
The Greek word meno, isn't it?
Meno, exactly.
Yeah.
I know he wants to move on to the Mormon subject, but very briefly, the reason it's a little bit smoother is that every other verse doesn't start with the word and. In other words, we didn't translate every wow consecutive and every chi if there was if there was no grammatical reason to do so.
Did you still retain the truly, truly I say to you in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and truly, truly in John? Did you?
I believe it still says truly. I don't think we certainly didn't go to verily anyways.
No. But you were doing truly, truly, which was excellent because it was copying. You know, the NASB had copied the RSV there, and I thought it was an excellent choice.
Yeah, I believe it's truly.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate your contribution.
It is truly, truly. Yeah.
It is truly, truly. Okay, good deal. Thanks
truly,
for calling.
Truly, truly, truly.
We'll get to the next caller here now. Who do we have? It's John in Midvale. John, you're on the air.
Gentlemen, I don't mean to sound heretical, but do you believe that there was a God before there was a written language?
Do you believe there was a God before there was a written language?
Mm-hmm.
A written language.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Christ is called the Word, that sort of...
No, that word stood for Logos and wisdom, if you believe the Greek.
The word Logos means about
Logos.
20 different things. Logos, okay.
Well, it's the Erasmian pronunciation.
Yeah, right.
I was just, you know... I mean,
I'm not sure what you're asking.
We see a great deal of... and I don't mind them. I mean, the Jesuits gave us... their debates over words gave us the Luther Calvin system. That the many camps of the various Protestants can argue today. And, you know, if you go back to some of the studies of the Old Testament, we see that it was the priests of Israel and the priests of Judea and the final redaction that gives us some of that that appears in the Old Testament.
John, what's your point?
It seems that we spend a great deal of time worrying about how the words mean, correct?
That's how we communicate. That's how we...
Not necessarily. I mean, we're talking about...
God could communicate in a little bit better way without necessarily words.
Exactly. Man tries to attempt his communication of what he understands God to be through words.
I don't believe that God has communicated?
Excuse me?
You don't believe God has communicated by language? When the prophets say, thus saith Yahweh, that's not Yahweh speaking?
No, thus saith the man who was communicated to by God, and I don't think God said exactly those words to him. I don't know.
Even though Jesus certainly believed that?
Well, certainly Jesus is one of the Trinity.
But Jesus had a extremely high view of Scripture.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you this about...
He wrote a lot of it, didn't he?
Well, obviously, that might have something to do with it. But it's amazing how many people today... But it's amazing, honestly, how many people today there are who call themselves Christian scholars who want to approach the text of the Old Testament without ever allowing that concept to have any say whatsoever into what it means. Now, I'm not saying you're doing that. I'm just simply saying that's something.
I am very much a believer that physics is the new metaphysics, and through the mentioned Pythagoras. I mean, Pythagoras' school there doesn't believe that one or two are numbers. Three is really the first number because one is unity; it isn't a number, and two is just distinction. And it's with three that we get what. In terms of their mathematics, the first number.
You sound like you have some familiarity with Pythagorean theory. John, we've got to get on to the next thing.
Just real quickly.
Okay.
Then. Okay. This idea that God exists outside Alpha Omega certainly doesn't allow it, but and certainly you haven't. But would you admit that it was the will of God that created space and time?
I don't agree that God created space or time. I believe he created the quantum structure of space and time, probably. I mean, that would be a good shot.
Not
space and time. I mean, I think space and time are just natural. Well, we're getting bumped off
natural.
Here for a thing here. We'll be right back on the air shortly. Sorry. Thank you, John. Okay, we're back on. Richard Hopkins here. Let's see. We're going to Richard in West Valley. Richard, you're on the air.
Mr. James White, You and I, we both know people whose cranium is crammed full of knowledge, but without an ounce of enlightenment to go with it.
Yes.
You know how the Trinity works?
You see, I have a feeling I'm about to find out.
I'm talking to Mr. Hawkins. I'm not talking to you, James White.
Oh, okay. I thought you were addressing.
It's okay. Look, you can be rude to me. That's okay. But I didn't want you to be rude to my guest.
That's basically what I get to.
Okay. What do you want to get to?
See, you have a lot of knowledge, but you don't have the enlightenment where the three persons come in. And what I explain is, do you know if you're created in God's image? There is three, do you know that there's three James sitting there? There is three of James sitting there. There's the physical James. Maybe he likes sports. I don't know what James physically likes. Maybe he likes playing with the kids. That's the physical James. The mental James likes the study of biblical history, the biblical, he probably studies different writings and books. Then there's the spiritual James, that studies the Bible, that prays. He communes with God. So if you're created in the image of God, then there is three of me, there is three of you, and that's why I don't see why you don't understand. There is three persons in one substance, just as there is three of me. And that's why Joseph Smith, I can show you a tape where Joseph Smith attacked that and said God would be a monster or a giant, one in three,
okay.
Three in one.
Richard, let me just cut you off here a little bit. I'm afraid James and I are going to have to agree on this one. Isn't this a heresy from back in the early second century? He's talking about... three Jameses all in one being. That reminds me of one of the modalists or Sabellian. Okay. All right. Well, are you saying that? Okay. Now, are you saying that these three Jameses are three separate individuals?
No. They're together.
Well, wait a minute. Okay.
They're three James.
If they're not three separate individuals, then you're not talking about the Trinity. The Trinity believes that the three are absolutely separate. Irenaeus, in Against Heresy, spent his entire book four trying to make this point over Marcion.
Not as I understand
so,
it.
I mean, no, believe me.
when you say completely separate, if you're talking about the fact that the Father is not the Son, that is quite true. If you're saying that the Father and the Son do not share one being as God, you're missing Irenaeus and Christians at that point. This is simply an analogy that he's using. Any analogy is going to break down, and it's not an analogy, to be perfectly honest with you, that I would use. Any analogy is going to break down for one simple reason, is we are describing the unique God, and since he is unique in how he exists, just as Jesus Christ was unique as the incarnate one, any analogy trying to describe how he exists is going to break down at some point along the line.
See, basically, what I'm basically saying, if you're talking in terms of a person, of a finite person, then you could say three dimensions. But if you're talking about a God, then you have three persons in one substance, as the late Dr. Walter Martin said, three persons in one substance. And even Catholicism agrees with three persons in one substance. So therefore, if you understand the Trinity, then you have to conclude that there is three Richard Hopkins in three dimensions in one substance, if you agree you're created in the image of God.
I don't agree that the analogy is going to work when applied to a finite creature, because the relationship that the Father, the Son, and the Spirit have is one of sharing an infinite being, not one-third of God's being. They're not one-third God, they are completely...
That's true. But the thing that I'm basically saying, the thing that's important is that if you believe you're created in the image of God, then it would only make sense that there is three of James as there is three of God. That's assuming that we're created in the imagination. Another term...
Wait a minute, Richard. Just before you go on, if there are three Jameses, okay, I got all three of them here in the studio, and I don't think that there's another one back in Arizona. Whereas when Christ was on the earth, there was, and he was baptized, there was one up in heaven speaking, and one down on the earth being baptized, and the Holy Ghost descending between the two, as if like it was a dove would descend. So there's three separate people you could see. I can't see three separate James Whites here. There's only one.
But it doesn't matter if James White is created in the image of God. You know that the angels cannot move around as God can. God can be in more than one place. The angels cannot. Neither can James nor I. But if I'm in the...
I can move around pretty good.
Do you know what the term imagination means? Image making. That's what's in the word imagination. Therefore, if I'm made in God's image, then there has to be three of me. I'm not God.
Well, there actually are three of you.
I'm finite. And God is infinite.
Well, one part of him is not finite, but anyway.
Richard, I think the key. I can't follow the analogy in applying it to people, but I can follow the analogy in recognizing. And the important part is
everything you say, I agree with.
I understand, but I'm just trying to point out to you that.
See, there's nothing that you can say that I would challenge. If you're in the image of God. Then there has to be, to me, three Jameses. You are like the angels. You cannot be in any more place than one, basically.
Richard, what I'm trying to point out, and just in briefly responding to that, is that the final thing that you said is what causes the problem with the analogy, and that is the concept of an infinite being versus a finite being. I don't believe... this would be one area, again, where I don't think Mormonism would have an infinite being.
Oh, incorrect. This is one of the areas that classical theism completely misunderstands Mormon doctrine on.
Oh.
As this gentleman was saying, and thank you, Richard, for your contribution, we have essentially three natures. Just as Christ had, as you recognize, at least two of the natures that he had while he was here upon the earth, a human nature and a spirit nature.
Divine nature.
Yes, what you call the divine nature, and we believe everybody has a spirit nature like that divine nature that Christ had. In other words, they were spirits
spirit
before
divine
they came
the same
here.
Thing.
Only, they are different only in degree. Like the butterfly is different from the caterpillar.
That both are created.
Well, not exactly. This is a point that I wanted to get across to you. They're not exactly created any more than a human body is created. You've got the third element in a human being, which is the intelligence that inhabits the spirit, or is the spirit. I don't know. There's nothing in the scriptures that clearly indicate to us how this is created or if it's begotten. But the point is that spirit has always existed. It is eternal. And it is intelligent, otherwise not the use of the word intelligence would be a misnomer. But the point is, it is intelligent, and it has learned, and it has existed throughout all eternity. And we do not know how long we have been in the spirit. We could have been in the spirit form for another infinite period of time. Who knows? I mean, an infinite period of time can be divided into an infinite number of infinite periods of time. So when you're talking infinity, you know, it's a very different thing. But the point is, man is infinite, not finite.
Have you ever read Dr. Beckwith's?
In its fundamental basis.
Have you ever read Dr. Beckwith's criticism of that very issue?
My book, the fourth section, is completely devoted rebutting is the word, Dr. Beckwith's thing. In fact, Dr. Beckwith's article was probably the inspiration in many ways for my book.
Thus declares Yahweh, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. You said man's spirit is eternal.
Yeah, no. I said his intelligence is.
Okay.
The spirit is formed.
Spirit is formed by Yahweh.
We would not say by Yahweh, by God the Father.
So Zechariah 12:1.
I understand what it's saying. Now, wait a minute, I'm not sure that it's Yahweh. Is it translated from Yahweh? Do you have that?
Mm-hmm. It is Yahweh.
Well, let me look.
Zechariah 12:1.
You said, for example, at the beginning of your talk with Van Hale, that God, that Yahweh spoke in the garden. Yahweh was the one who said, "Let us make man." But that's not correct. It was Elohim that said.
That, of course, assumes that Yahweh and Elohim are separate and distinct gods. The Bible very clearly says they are not.
No, of course not. They're not separate gods. They're separate persons.
That's not according to the Bible.
Well,
Yahweh says
Yahweh is one person.
Deuteronomy 4:35. To show that you might know that Yahweh, He is Elohim. There is none else beside Him. Milbadu is singular.
He represents Elohim and is speaking just the way that messenger spoke to John in the first person.
Yahweh says there is no, that Yahweh,
no other
He
God.
Is Elohim. If you say James, He is Richard.
Right.
Where did the angel ever say, I am God in Revelation? He didn't.
That isn't the point.
To you it was shown that you might know that Yahweh, He is Elohim. There is none else beside Him, singular, not
let's
them,
get it out. What
plural.
Is it? Where is it?
That's Deuteronomy
4:35. 4:35. Let's get it.
And I looked up Zechariah 12:1 for you if you'd like to see it.
No, just a minute. Let me get this. I see. Deuteronomy 12:35, right?
4:35.
Oh, 4. That's what I thought it was. Now, why am I not at there? Right. There's no other besides Him.
No, read the rest of it.
It says, To you is shown that you might know that the Lord, He is God.
That, look at
the, that's right.
I thought you were looking at your interlinear.
No, I'm not, but I know the Lord is translated Yahweh.
And God
is Elohim. Exactly.
And what else does it say?
There is no other beside Him.
Him is singular. So you've
right.
got Yahweh, He is Elohim, there is none else beside Him.
And
yet in Mormon theology,
that,
Elohim begat Yahweh
yes,
as His firstborn spirit child.
And this would be understood as follows, that you might know that the Lord, He is God in
Elohim.
The same sense that He is representing God. He is the angel of God. He is God to you. Period.
I didn't see that in my Hebrew text anymore.
No, but that is what the meaning is. That's how you should understand
that
it.
That is where your Mormon
saying.
Presuppositions are determining
there
your exegesis.
There is no other besides. Exactly. I mean, you cannot. You do eisegesis as well. I mean, we all bring a certain amount of eisegesis to the Scriptures because we interpret them. We exegete them using our fundamental suppositions.
But if you're going to ask the question, are Jehovah and Elohim separate and distinct gods, 535 times,
it's
Yahweh, Elohim, one term, Psalm 100, verse 3, Jehovah, He is Elohim, Jehovah, He is Elohim, and Jehovah says, I know of no other Elohim besides Me.
That is not inconsistent with LDS theology.
If you wish to say so.
Okay, we've got somebody else we need to do this. I wish I could go into this more extensively. My new book does, and you should look at that.
There's Zechariah 12:1. It's Yahweh creates spirits, forms spirits.
Okay, we've got a few more people we have to get on here, and let's go to, who's next on there? Who? Just put them on. Go on.
Hi, this is John.
John?
Great show you got tonight. First of all, a couple, about half an hour ago, you were discussing whether the difference between creation and begetting.
Yes, we were.
And how man was created in the image of God, and that's different from Seth being begat in the image of Adam.
Right.
And I would like to take issue with that when you look at, in the Gospel of John, first chapter, 14th verse, where we read that the Word, referring to Jesus Christ, was made flesh, and He's the only begotten of the Father.
Mm-hmm.
So if He's the only begotten of the Father, then there is a difference in interpretation of when we look and it says that if in other places Christ will say, if you've seen Me, you've seen the Father. You know, we look the same. We essentially act as one God. And so if you look at the difference here, there is no difference between Seth being begat in the image of Adam and mankind being created in the image of God. It's all the same.
Actually, if you're basing that upon John 1:14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glories of the term, the Greek term is monogenes, And if you will look up the term monogenēs in any decent lexical source at all, you will see that monogenēs refers to uniqueness.
Actually, I was referring to the 14th verse where where he's referred to as the only begotten of the Father.
Exactly. Yes. The Greek term is monogenēs.
Which James thinks means...
unique, one of a kind.
Yeah. Monogenēs comes from two words in Greek, which mean first... Let's see. First...
Well, you're thinking of
monogenēs
now.
Only child, right?
It only can child. Be used to mean
that
only
would be
child.
What it means. Only child.
It can mean that.
Well,
it comes from monos, and it does not come from genao, the verb to beget. It comes from genes, which means race or kind.
Exactly.
So it means unique one. That's why it's translated that way at John 1:18 in modern translations, the unique God.
Okay. So
wait a minute.
That would be the same. Is that the same as in 1 John chapter 4 verse 9 then?
1 John 4:9.
Yeah, I believe it is. James, there's a problem that what he's talking about relates to, and that is exactly your argument based on Deuteronomy 4:35 is exactly why I have a problem with the idea of the Trinity being a separate Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Why?
Well, because right here you're saying they're not separate.
No, I'm saying that Jehovah and Elohim, that those terms are used of the only true God in the Old Testament.
Well,
the Father is Jehovah Elohim, the Son...
Are they separate beings?
Father and Jehovah and Elohim.
Is there Father, Son, and Holy Ghost in the Old Testament?
Of course there were.
Okay, then you have the same problem with this scripture that we do.
Not at all.
Oh yes, because you have to explain why.
We believe there's only one God, Jehovah Elohim. You believe that Elohim's Father and Jehovah is the Son.
Then we explain this scripture in exactly the same way. It's just that we do not assume the additional idea that that these three separate persons are one being. That we do not assume.
No, you're inserting a doctrinal exposition from 1916 interpreting Deuteronomy chapter 4.
No, I'm certainly not. I'm trying to explain to you
how
we see this as... No, you have the same problem as we do with this.
Not at all.
No, you believe that there's one God. We believe there's one God.
Yahweh Elohim.
Well, fine. We believe that would constitute the one Godhead, we would call it. And my point is...
One being of God, Yahweh Elohim.
No, okay, there's only one, right?
Right.
All right. We believe that's one authority. You believe that's one being.
Exactly.
All right, there's the difference.
We're getting there. Good.
Okay. I am saying to you that one being is not going to be three separate persons.
Why not? Let us make man in our
impossible.
Image. No, it's...
Let us make man in our own
where
image.
Where does it say it's impossible? In fact, that passage right there says there is none else beside him, not there's not none else beside that authority.
No.
You're reading him as authority.
No, I'm not. I'm reading him as the Father. The source of the authority.
Yahweh Elohim. That's Yahweh speaking.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got two separate persons there.
We don't have any problem with the fact that the Son is identified as Yahweh, the Father is identified as Yahweh, and the Spirit is identified as Yahweh. It's the Mormon idea of introducing this distinction between Yahweh and Elohim that I was saying I was disagreeing with when you said it's not...
Okay,
it wasn't Jehovah that said that in Genesis 1.
Then let me clarify. There are, and this is correct, I mean, generally speaking, Jehovah refers to, as even Justin Martyr indicated, it was Christ that dealt throughout the Old Testament with the people of Israel. The problem is, and that is what we identify Yahweh, but the words for God, Yahweh and Elohim, that are used in the Bible are frequently used interchangeably, as you've just suggested. But that does not mean that the three separate persons are one being.
The fact that one divine name is used for all three, and that is the only divine name there is, does.
Okay.
And I point out to you, Isaiah 53:6, it is Yahweh that laid our sins upon the Messiah.
Well, I've got to get into that more at a later time, but
there's another general conference in 6 months.
We'll do it then. We've got to do that, but we've only got 3 minutes, and we got a few people to go here. Let's go to, who do we have? Carrie? Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I have a question for James, and I'm asking very, I just want to know, James, what is your relationship to Jesus the Christ?
He is my Lord and my Savior and my Creator.
Your Creator.
He is my Creator.
Okay.
Mine too, by the way, James.
Yeah,
I thought he was your spirit brother.
Me too. No, he is my elder brother.
Creator.
He absolutely
is. He formed your spirit?
As far as forming my spirit, I don't have an opinion.
I thought Elohim begat your spirit with one of his heavenly wives.
Well, that's one person's interpretation of it. I'm not.
That's a general authority's interpretation.
Yes, that's one general authority's interpretation of it.
Okay, you're still on. I'm sorry.
That's my interpretation also. Now, when the Lord is being baptized by John, whom is he speaking to, or who's speaking to the Lord?
The Father.
the Father. And who would that be? Yahweh, Elohim, Jesus, who?
The Father is the Father, the Son is the Son, the Spirit is the Spirit. Each one is described as with the one term Yahweh, which is again why we believe in the doctrine of the Trinity, Yahweh referring to the being of God, each shared fully by three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit.
Thank you, Gina. I'm sorry we don't have more time. We're trying to try to get Doug in here. Doug and Georgia?
Georgia.
Georgia.
Doug from Georgia. Hello, James.
Hello.
I don't know if you know who I am or not.
No, I don't.
I don't know if anybody's brought this up or not. How about, what do you make of the Mosser Owen article? Paul Mosser, Paul Owen speech of a year ago has been printed out and circulated around.
I told them it was a bad idea at the time, and I still think it is.
Do you agree with that conclusion?
Okay,
no,
we've got
really.
1 minute left. Thank you, Doug. I wish we had more time, but we want to get one more caller in. Let's see.
That was fast.
We're not going to be able to get much in. Okay, I'm sorry. We are not going to be able to get any more callers in.